Hey guys, it's Andy here in another episode of the Mountain Malarkey podcast with Dave.
Hello, everybody.
How are we doing, Dave?
Yeah, not bad.
We realised that when we do the Tuesday tune-in over on Facebook, which we've been doing during lockdown, we had some comments and requests around, you know, not everyone's on Facebook, but people still wanted to hear about the content. There's been some great stuff. We've talked about bags. We've talked about Battle of the Treks. We talked about trekking boots, mindset, fitness, loads of stuff. And we thought to ourselves, well, why don't we turn these into podcasts? Because, like you said, Dave, they're sitting down listening for an hour.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This is a great format. You can do it on the go, put it in your car, listen to it. It's a bit interactive, so you're going to have seen us answer questions and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's a little bit different.
You know, but if you're listening to this, obviously, and you have any questions about any of the things you hear, podcast@evertrek.co.uk.
Awesome, Dave. Yeah, enjoy the episode, and we'll catch up with you soon.
Yeah, all the best.
Today we've got a special guest, James.
Thank you.
Oh. Sorry, Dave, you're always special.
Yeah. That's what they tell me. That's what they say.
yeah, we got James from the Altitude Centre. James, welcome to the Tuesday tune in, mate.
Hi guys, good to see you. Been a little bit of time since we've spoken.
It has, isn't it? It has. I know for people who've tuned in or seen you before, obviously, I know probably about 2 years ago now, we came to your, I think it was the old Altitude Centre, hasn't it? Because you've moved since.
That's right, yeah.
I think that was, we put Dave through some misery.
Yeah, went on the bike. Fowler laughs at us.
I reckon we can time it by your injuries, because you've just fallen off a mountain bike or something, not to bring that one back.
Yeah, so I have, yeah. So it was 2021. Yeah, I think it was pre-operation.
Yeah.
So I think it was around June 2021.
God, really? Has it been that much? Yeah. Well, we got to come back down, James. It's been way too long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, but of course, also...
New facility are here, so we'll get you back in and we'll put you through it all again.
Amazing!
Is it
amazing?
We'll swap positions this time? Is it you get the easy walk? I'll get the
Because I remember that, because I was on the I thought the knee, maybe the cycling will be better, because I thought he was going to be running on the treadmill. If it was a gentle walk, oh, that's all right. This, and then I remember one point where James said, "Yeah, just take." Bring the cadence up a little bit, and I'm thinking, what? And when you see those two sacks just get completely empty, and then they weren't refilling, and I think you said, you're not getting any benefit from this now, Dave. You may as well start.
I think he was looking at your data and thinking, yeah, we need to stop.
Yeah, we're going to lose him. But honestly, it was amazing. It was really, really fascinating going down there, I think, in terms of just the different things that you can learn. I quite like the fact you've got that sort of gym area that's kind of like hanging around at Namche. I remember that there was a quite successful boxer. She was training in there. I've forgotten her name now. Hannah, maybe?
Yeah, that's it. That's exactly it. Yeah, world champion boxer. Yeah, and I think that's the thing, kind of, it's an interesting thing with altitude training, about it in the context of mountaineering here today, you know, and going to base camp, Kilimanjaro, all the rest of it. But so much to be gained from kind of a fitness point of view. You know, right now we're building up to spring marathons in the next couple of weeks, you know, London Marathon, all of these, you know, people going off and riding bikes in the Alps in the summer, or, you know, just looking to get a little bit fitter with the help of altitude. So yeah, loads of different people hanging around the centre now.
Nice. Awesome. Yeah. Cause it's, as you said, there's so many things that, you know, spending a bit of time pre-acclimatizing, it can help amongst many things. Obviously here, I know we're talking about, you know, our trips and some of the altitude stuff that we're doing, but it can have a lot of benefits across any active thing that you're doing, right? It helps like runners, mountain bikers, you know, road bikers, anything really.
Just turn your body into a far more efficient oxygen transportation machine, I think, is the goal.
Exactly. Who we got on there?
That's what it says about us.
You can have that, James. You can have that.
Sorry, James. I think it's a bit of a delay. I know I'm saying it, and it's like, wee, wee. It's like being on WhatsApp. You know, you get WhatsApp calls, and you're like,
yeah.
You feel like you're talking, so I'll try and pause after I speak. Sorry, mate. But yeah, just to say a few more people on the live. We've got Des Lally. Here we go. Yo, you pair of cold water warriors. Yes, Dez, he's been spotting us at the cold.
We've been stealing his spot. Dez is actually one of the people that kind of first. I remember when he said, "Oh, you'd love the cold war." I was like, "Nah, sick of it. Never going to do it." Now I am thoroughly addicted to the feeling of getting from cold war. I've done it every single week since the day after Boxing Day.
Yeah.
Gone up there and done it. Not like Dez. Dez gets up there at like 3 o'clock in the morning and does a summit. I'll rock up at 11 and just go for a dip. But I love the feeling of that sort of stuff. But awesome. Yeah, Dez is amazing.
Nice to see you, Dez. Who else we got? We got John. Obviously, we've got Sophie, one of our Yetis at Hereford. How you doing, Sophie? And then we've got Stuart. Your attitude, not your aptitude, will determine your attitude.
What? Altitude.
Ziggler. Hi, guys. I know you mean. Sorry, Stuart. I'm just reading it. It's because it's quite far away. Dave, I need your glasses.
Yeah. No, you got it right.
It's good. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's a good system.
I was looking for altitude in there.
I think it's meant to be. But yeah, that's what I'm
saying. We got Pratesh. We got Dewey. Hey, Dewey. Nice to see you. Dewey popped in a couple of weeks back. Oh, yeah, nice to see a familiar face. We got Shell. We got Nigel. Marky B. Jim, how you doing, Jim? Oh, nice to see some Evertrekkers who have been around for a while.
And Shell, who's a newbie, actually.
Shell is a
newbie. I'm most happy about Shell being here, if I'm honest. The other guys, I've seen them a lot.
Oh, tell them that.
But I think, Shell, you're going to love this one. You've picked the perfect one to join because altitude and topics around altitude are always our most popular Tuesday tune-ins. So today is going to be awesome.
Exactly. And I suppose where to start, James, obviously for some of the newer Evertrekkers, who might not have heard about the Altitude Centre before. Be good to give a little intro, I think, into what the Altitude Centre does. And obviously yourself, James, if that's okay.
Yeah, of course. Pardon me. So, I mean, the Altitude Centre, we've been going 20 years now as a company, founded in 2003, initially with the goal of bringing altitude training to elite athletes in this country. We were talking before about, runners, cyclists, triathletes, that sort of person. So, in the build-up to the 2012 games, we're providing altitude training for elite athletes, all of this sort of thing. But really in the last sort of 10, 15 years, really been a transition. Mountaineering's become so popular, and actually the ability to pre-acclimate before you head out to the mountains and just give yourself that head start has become something that, there's been a real demand for. We've got our center here in London, where I'm talking to you from now, and we've got a few different bits and pieces on site. Really, you can imagine this as a small gym where basically the whole room is at high altitude, so a few treadmills, a couple of watt bikes, that sort of thing at high altitude, and then a few more specialist bits of kit. So actually downstairs in the performance lab, we'll do some really high altitude training, so trek specific activities at kind of 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 meters. And then some kind of other environmental stuff as well. So although, less so what we're talking about today, full environmental chamber that we've got on site that can do heat and humidity and this sort of thing as well. Nice. People are going and trekking through the desert, doing marathon de sable, these sorts of things. So really anything kind of environmental training, we've got it ticked off, and that's on site. Or for people training at home, we rent the equipment out and people can do it in the comfort of their own home. And that's what I brought to Wales on the training weekend.
Yeah, which was literally people's breath was literally taken away when you got that out. sorry, couldn't resist. But it was, I had to get one.
No, I know. Hey, let's get them out now.
exactly. But it was great though, because you got, and I suppose, with the Altitude Centre and seeing how you cope with altitude and seeing the numbers, certainly your heart rate, your oxygen levels change when you breathe in. Like you said, you took some people up to equivalent of say 5,500 meters, which is a little bit higher than Everest Base Camp, a little bit lower than Kilimanjaro. And to see at that moment, like what it actually does to your body in that situation. For people who haven't felt that before, I think it gives them a real kind of example of what it might feel like.
Absolutely.
Obviously, you don't go, when you start a trek, obviously you don't go straight to 5,500 meters, hopefully. unless you cheat on a chopper or something. We don't want to be doing that.
Yeah. Or there's a plane crash. About the Andes thing, when they did that.
Wow.
Yeah, strange story. That's a strange little story. Yeah, ask me about the Andes one, guys, if you're interested, but I'm not going to hijack this live. with that, but it's a great story. Not the eaten one.
Oh, that's what I was thinking.
Oh, not alive. This is a different one. Remember, that crashed on a peak higher.
Illumani.
Yeah, and it's really strange because they never recovered any of the wreckage or the people. And when you go up there, they were smuggling in illegal snake skins.
I heard about that.
So they're all frozen into the mountain.
It's an outside magazine did an article about it and a podcast. It was really good.
And that happened at quite high altitude. Bring it back. Coming full circle. Yeah, exactly. But no, it is fascinating. That is one of the things that I truly believe about altitude. And there seems to be two schools of thought on the subject of going there, which is just train hard, do your best, but don't think about it. But I much prefer the knowledge dispels fear side of things. Yeah. The more you know about a subject, the less anxious of it and that you are.
Yeah.
And so I found actually, although I knew a little bit, going down and learning about, sort of surface level, what altitude sickness is, what it does, but actually to understand the physiology of it and things, it helps you know what to do to manage it. I think, James, that's one of the things you guys do really well is
I think
provide info behind the,
I think you hit the nail on the head there. You need to respect altitude, but not fear it. I think it's probably the balance that you want to be striking. And as you say, just understanding it is the key thing. So, when people come and see us for the first time, we generally put them through a little bit of testing, which is what we're talking about right at the start there, the mountaineering consultation, get a bit of an understanding of how they respond to high altitude, because it's just such an unknown. And that's what brings the fear is the unknown nature of it. So if you can get a bit of an understanding of how you respond, what you can then start to do about it, what it feels like, how it might start to affect you, all of these sorts of things, then it just brings the anxiety level down. And we know that the people who are most anxious about altitude suffer the worst with it as well. So if we can, on that psychosomatic level, bring that down a notch, then, we're onto a winner.
Funny enough.
Which is a biggie, isn't it? And sorry, Dave, just around the people feeling anxious about it is, a lot of the treks I've been on, whether it be base camp, maybe in Machu Picchu or Tubcal, if you haven't felt altitude before, and it's not like, when you're hiking, it's not like there's a shortness of air. You feel like you're breathing the same, but obviously your body might be reacting in a different way. And if you haven't felt that before, or you're worried about it, it's like anything, isn't it? If all you're thinking is altitude sickness, it's no doubt, if anyone's going to suffer, it's going to be you.
Yeah. And you start second guessing yourself as well. You go, well, I've got a headache. Yeah. Is that altitude sickness? Well, you're RR. So, yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, sorry, you are cracking on his questions, I think.
The first guide, my guide on my first trip to Everest Base Camp, he was telling us that, a lot of the, not the majority, but a significant amount of people that perhaps turn back and walk down is due to sort of the panic, and the anxiety around it. And exactly like you said, they start monitoring, like your body will change and you will experience sort of the side effects of altitude, or rather the effects of altitude. But that doesn't necessarily mean altitude sickness, acute AMS and abort. But as soon as people start noticing anything different, they associate it with sort of the negative connotations of altitude, and then immediately panic. Panic leads onto all sorts of things like shortness of breath, headaches, and where actually, if you understand what's going to happen to your body and prepare yourself for those changes, then when it does happen, you're like, I expected this. That's fine. That's normal. I'll crack on. Exactly. And I think it makes a big difference.
Yeah. No. Exactly. So some good questions coming in as well, and we will come to those questions in a wee bit. Some really good ones. Keep them coming, by the way. I know some of our Yetis just noting them down, and we'll ourselves and James will tackle them in due course. But James, just around the science bit, because obviously I know we're talking about altitude here and all, how we deal with it. But it'd be interesting just to hear a little bit about like why, like acclimatization, what happens to our body when we go to altitude? Probably the science question, but just to explain that.
That's fine. I mean, that's fine. That's my background in the science of it. So when you go to altitude, it's the oxygen, right? It's not altitude per se. It's the fact that when you're at 3,000, 4,000 meters, there's less oxygen available to you. And that means that to the unacclimated person, there's then going to be less oxygen in the blood. And your body doesn't necessarily have an altimeter. It doesn't see 4,000 meters. It sees the amount of oxygen in your blood. So if that's not where it wants to be, or it's lower than it ought to be, then you start to react to it from there. So some of those responses are useful. You start breathing more quickly, more deeply, try and get more oxygen into your body in the first instance. Your heart rate goes up a little bit just to pump that oxygen out to the periphery, into your brain where it's being used. But some of those responses are not so good. So, you know, as you guys well aware, you know, being altitude all the time, your blood thickens, you get thick blood going through your brain, you start to get that headache that's characteristic of mild altitude sickness. And then for people who aren't acclimating so well, the symptoms kind of continue from there. So headache, nausea, those sorts of things. And that's what we want to avoid. And I think that's what people fear will happen to them before they go, really.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, thanks for explaining that. It's always interesting because I know that, you know, the first time I went to altitude, which was Everest Base Camp, you know, I didn't really have any knowledge around the science of it. I knew it existed. And obviously, like you said, it's more about the oxygen rather than the altitude as such, because, you know, your body's trying to transport and get oxygen to all of the organs as best it can. And it adjusts to cope with that. But it was weird not knowing any of that and going out there. And then, you know, my first experience wasn't, I would say I didn't. I drank beer probably 2 days into a trek in Namche, which wasn't the best. I soon learned that trekking with a hangover is probably not the best thing to do. And this was obviously, there wasn't ever trek around then. And I know there's an altitude center, but I hadn't been to the altitude center. So I didn't have any knowledge about it. It's interesting after learning all this, how your approach can change. And certainly now, and one thing we share obviously on the training weekends and like here today as well, anyone that goes to altitude, there's obviously some basics that you do or not do, if we think about alcohol, that you can put in place that will help you anyway. I think it's worth talking about, you know, hydration, which is the number one, really, isn't it, when it comes to
100%. Beer doesn't count, I don't think, does it?
No. Beer definitely doesn't count. I know I've had my worst altitude sickness, and really it's been underpinned by dehydration. You know, we recommend sort of drinking 3-4 liters of water a day, another liter of water on top of that again if you take Diamox on any given day as well, because it's so dehydrating being up at altitude. You're losing water through your urine, through your breath, from the dry air, all of this, and as I say, then you start getting thick blood moving through your brain, and you're in for a hard time at that point. Being on top of your hydration is absolutely key. And I think, you know, one thing that you kind of alluded to there as well is how the altitude can affect people differently for the same height, but everybody can put the same steps in place to make sure that they're giving themselves the best opportunity to deal with the altitude as they can. So hydration chief amongst those, but, you know, walking slowly, all of those sorts of things, just absolutely key.
I find the worst trek that I ever did, the worst I felt on a trek was, it was actually on the descent. And it was the time when I went to base camp in spring 2019. I didn't feel well before I went. And I actually started to get, I think, quite ill on the way down. And that's because I didn't feel very well. I stopped drinking just before I got to base camp. So I was probably getting through maybe a litre and a half a day at about 4,500 meters to base camp and back. So I was actually okay until I got to that point. I didn't suffer any particular symptoms.
Mm. Yeah.
But then just because I started to feel really rough and I started to, and it wasn't related to altitude. This is a separate issue. I went there with shingles and it got worse because I was on it. It was getting better. And then as I went to altitude, it got worse. And then I stopped drinking as much. And I noticed even though I was going down, I started to feel what I thought, getting way more headaches and stuff like that. And it wasn't until I actually thought about it.
Yeah.
And I realized I hadn't filled my bladder up in 2 days. I had just been using the ball. And that was
so don't do that.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. But it was because I didn't want the weight on the rash.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was lightening the thing. But I realized very quickly afterwards, after a couple of days on the way down, oh my God, I'm starting to feel a bit rough. Started taking more water, like Nex, some electrolytes and a couple of liters straight away.
Yeah.
And within a matter of hours, it is remarkable. Like, it didn't take the next day. I didn't have to sleep. I started drinking, like, once we stopped hiking at about 4. Yeah. And by about 8 or 9, I started to feel a million times better.
Yeah. Especially because you'd obviously achieved getting to Everest Base Camp.
Yeah.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because you're almost, like, mentally down tools, even though actually your journey back is still a three beastie few days. Yeah. You're still at altitude.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And, you know, even after 2 days of trekking from base camp, you're still at Namshi, which is 3,400 odd meters. So I think that's the one thing. It's important to maintain that sort of, the sort of tools you use in terms of pace and things like that, even when you're still at that altitude.
Definitely.
Yeah. One of and I think the flip side of what you said there, sorry to cut across, is how quickly the altitude sickness and the headache and that side of things went away when you did drink. It can come on that quickly as well. You know, to go back to my experience, I'm talking about there with Kilimanjaro, you know, the headache, those symptoms came on across the course of 2-3 hours. I wasn't drinking enough. We're not talking about, you know, okay, you're saying about not drinking enough across the course of a couple of days. You know, we'll have that. If you don't drink enough across the course of a couple of hours, then suddenly you're dehydrated and you're in trouble. So it works both ways on that one. Just being on top of it the whole way through is key.
Yeah, you got to be like a basking shark, I find, you know, just sort of like walking through the Himalaya with your mouth open, just filtering water. It goes in your mouth and out your whatever. but it is like, I remember on Kilimanjaro, I was like complaining to you because Kilimanjaro was the first time that I'd ever taken Dymox.
Yeah.
And that turbocharged the process. So I had to learn like to drink enough so I could stop an hour or two before I went to bed. Otherwise, you're up and down. I said, it's like water flossing, you know, but for your whole body. And that's one thing I know is going to come up as well is about medications and Dymox and things you can take supplementary to the natural way of acclimatizing. One of the big questions we get asked quite a lot is, and I know there's not a specific answer, but I really love to get your insight, is how and when should I take Dymox if I've already planned on taking it? You know, what's your go-to response for that? Because I know that's going to be something that people want to know.
Oh, 100%. I mean, look, the go-to is that we're not medical professionals and we can't say what you can and can't do.
Can we bring that up on the screen?
Yeah, very, very quick to say that. But look, the two main schools of thought that we have and that people have around Dymox is to either kind of take it as a course of medication, on a preventative basis, so kind of load up on it 1 or 2 days before you go or before you're at altitude and then continue to take it all the way through as a preventative. And the flip side is then to use it basically just to relieve any symptoms as they do come on. I've personally never had to use Dymox at high altitude. It's worth taking it when you're at home, even if you don't plan to use it, you know, when you're on the mountain, even if you only plan to use it, worst case scenario, you know, on that front. Just because it is a drug, it does have some side effects, as you know, it talks about the diuresis, but like any drug, it does have some, you know, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000 side effects that people, you want to be aware of how you respond to it. But yeah, you can take it in one of those two ways. And I think the key thing really, as we talked about there, is hydration. Any given day when you do take it, another liter of water on top of what you're already drinking is non-negotiable. Otherwise, you're putting something into your body that's dehydrating you. And one of the main things that contributes to, or one of the big things that contributes to altitude sickness is dehydration. So it just becomes that cycle. And for me, that's why I'll only use it when I need it, just to stave that one off, really. So yeah, more of a personal opinion on that one than anything else.
I think that's the same as, you know, we have similar opinions. I think, you know, it's one of those, it's a tool, that you could use, you know, and especially in certain countries, like in the Everest region, certainly on our trips, all of our guides do carry it, again, as a tool, you know, obviously that, you know, they're not handing them out like Smarties, but you know, you know, you've got, obviously it's a drug that you can take that, you know, I've seen absolutely game-changing results from it with people. I've never really taken it myself. I had half a tablet of Gorexhep once from one of my guides. I was like, heart rate's at 120. Can I have half a tablet? I need a good sleep.
But that's a good point, though. I think you've said about sleep there and around how you dose with Dymox. So, you know, 250 milligram tablet, generally speaking, you can take that all in one go, but often we'll have people kind of dose it a little bit. So you might wake up in the morning, you're feeling a bit groggy, half a tablet then. And then, as you said, difficulty getting to sleep is very common at altitude if someone's not acclimatizing very well, or they've not had the benefit of doing the pre-acclimation. And so half a tablet there can help with that as well. But as you said, Davey, then weighing up, you know, sleeping well, but being up every couple of hours to
Yeah, peeing.
It was about that. Yeah. That's one, because every trip that I'd done, except for the first one, because I didn't really know much about Dimox when I first went there. I learned about it on the trip. I think you'd said briefly, you could take this if you want, but you won't need it. And then
that's because my opinion has changed. Yeah. Also, you know, seeing literally hundreds and hundreds of Evertrackers use it and reach, you know, where they were getting to.
And I learned about it when I was out there, because you see it everywhere, you know, because it's, you know, it's trekking.
It's well used now. Yeah. It's well known.
So, but when I took it on Kilimanjaro, it was that. It was sort of reactive.
Yeah.
I had it. I like to treat my way of doing it, and it might not be right for everyone, is I think, like, well, it's like any paracetamol or ibuprofen. You know, I'm not going to take one in case I have a headache or a sore knee. I'll take it in response to and just do my best to try and work things out without taking any extra stuff.
Yeah.
So I only took half a pill in the morning, half in the evening, and that was enough. So and the main side effects I got from it, aside from needing to pee a lot more, which seemed to be worse in the night.
Excuse me.
And I think this is because what you drink during the day, you're kind of sweating out a lot when you're hiking. And then when you're sat down in the tent and you're not actually sweating more, you're sort of retaining a lot more of what you drink. So you need to pee. I don't know if that's true, but that's certainly how my...
Yeah.
But the worst side effect was just really specific and odd tingling, like pins and needles, like one half of my tongue.
Fingers and toes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, fingers and toes often people get tingling there.
Yeah. It's weird. It's not unpleasant, but it's kind of there. You know, and I remember...
Like pins and needles.
I remember my father took Dimox when we went back to Everest Base Camp the second time.
Yeah.
And he kept stopping and he was like, I think my boot's too tight. I was like, well, he's like, I'm getting pins and needles in my toes. And I watched him faff around with his boots for about an hour off and on. And then I was like, oh, no, they're fine. I was like, I know why this is happening to you. And I remembered
Brilliant. Some really good questions come in as well. I think we'll tackle on this sec. But James, just want to circle back, obviously, to the facilities and also as well, you know, some of the Evertrekkers that have also been with you. Like one of them, Stuart Taylor here. I'll bring in, see if I can bring him in on the bottom there. Hey, Stuart, I hope all is well, by the way. Nice to see you. Love your profile picture. I think that's Killy Summit, isn't it? Hi, James. Trained at the Altitude Center last year before Killy. The breathing techniques learned were invaluable as we're learning how to spot signs of possible altitude sickness. It's not all here, but I remember one of the team saying you can only recreate the altitude to a certain height. Is this true and why? Say for 8,000 meter peaks? I suppose then, you've obviously got facilities there. You can take them up to a certain height, can't you?
Yeah, we can go up to 6,500 meters on that one. And that's across the different training types that we have at this facility. So, you know, a couple of different types of training that people will do. We'll often layer in to begin with, just passively breathing very high altitudes. So it's a little bit like doing interval training, but just for your breathing. So you're sitting there, you're breathing through a mask, which is hooked up to a generator. It does 5 minutes at altitude and 5 minutes at sea level. Just repeating that through across the course of an hour. And that's something that can be done at home or on site here. And that's at altitudes of up to 6,500 meters. And then as people progress through and become more comfortable with that, we'll then layer in a little bit of walking as well. So we get people walking, box stepping, those sorts of trek-specific activities at those same sorts of heights. So look, the idea being there, as I say, it's a little bit like interval training. So we're just exposing you for a short period of time to those very high altitudes to get the adaptations that we want and get the body used to it. But even for people who are going up for Everest Summit or, you know, we had a couple of guys train with us for some of your Aconcagua trips at the start of the year.
Yeah.
Obviously going higher than 6,500 meters. Yeah, absolutely. And Sarah and Rahul. And look, the answer is there that we want to get you as comfortable as you can at those heights, because the highest that you can really acclimatize to is about 6,500 meters.
Yeah.
Above that, to some extent, the body is, you know, for want of a better word, degrading. But if we can get you as possibly can at 6,000 meters, then every, you know, 100, 200, 300 meters above that becomes a little bit easier. So it's all about just getting as comfortable as you can at the highest possible height that we can.
Yeah. Nice. And just off the back of that as well, obviously with the facilities, I know that obviously all Evertrekkers who are booked on trips, just a reminder as well, in our members area, you can click on the little icon, there's a little thumbnail there with the Altitude Center, and we'll take you through to a landing page. You can fill in some details. And obviously then is it a training consultation? Is that right, James?
That's right. Yeah. So have a book on for an online training consultation, half an hour, sit down via Zoom with a member of the team. to discuss all things altitude, really. Get your questions answered specifically, because people have always got questions. And, you know, there are no silly questions when it comes to altitude. It is such an unknown. You know, you want to get those questions answered. But just then to talk through some of the key things, understand a little bit more about your background, you know, your history with altitude, because I think the great thing with Evertrek, you know, a lot of people going to altitude for the first time, but a lot of people with experience as well, and actually able to tailor it from there. You know, they go, well, I went to base camp and I got sickness at this height. I did this, you know, whatever, whatever. Now I'm going to Kilimanjaro and I want to avoid that. Well, okay, can we go through, can we diagnose almost, you know, look back and dissect what's happened in your previous trip and make some adjustments going forward. So yeah, sit down, have that conversation with us via Zoom, and then look, you know, build a bit of a plan of action from there as appropriate for you, really. But yeah, hopefully a really useful resource for all Evertrekkers who have booked onto trips.
Yeah, I highly recommend people do it. I mean, the first time we went down, I found it really fascinating, and I'd already been to altitude quite a few times, but there's always more you can learn, and it's always and also just the curiosity aspect of sort of knowing what I experienced at altitude and then actually going sort of looking behind why I experienced that. It was really fascinating.
And no two trips are the same either. Sorry to cut across it, just a delay. But no two trips are the same. You know, we'll have people who go, well, I went to Kilimanjaro and now I'm going to Toubkal, so I'm not worried about it, it's not so high. Well, actually, it's a very different trip. You're gaining the elevation on Toubkal in 2 or 3 days. Really different challenge. You're not going as high, but you're going far more quickly. So how do we do things differently from there? You know, and you know, you talk about having the experience already, but going somewhere else. I think there's a lot of value in that for people, hopefully.
Funny enough, Mohammed, my guide on Toubkal, I turned back on Toubkal, because again, it wasn't very very well. And he was convinced I had altitude sickness. I didn't. I had another in sort of infection, but he was talking to me about it, and he said that actually more people reach the summit of Kilimanjaro than Toubkal.
Really?
He says a lot of people, or rather his experience, and it is his experience, is that people who have done Kilimanjaro come to Toubkal with a view that it's going to be a lot easier. But actually, you're right, it's like 1,000+ meters of ascent.
Yeah, it's tough.
You know, and you're not really acclimatized because you haven't had long, you know, you're in Marrakesh, then all of a sudden you're at like 3.2, and then all of a sudden you're above 4. So he said it's actually, a lot of people find it quite brutal.
Yeah. I know we got a bunch of questions. I think we've got loads, actually, so it's good. We'll crack on with them, James, if that's okay.
Of course.
And we'll swing back to things. Dave, you have one for
Shelley. Yeah, Shelley wants to know, she said, hi there, this sounds ace. Could I please ask the following? Would you recommend taking electrolytes in addition to drinking plenty of water at high altitude? Thanks so much. I might add on to that as well, because I have a question. Like, do you think there is any particular vitamins and things like that that are beneficial, or like natural supplements and things like that that you could do? So Shelley's question, and I bolted my bit onto it as well.
Shelley's question, I think there is probably value in that for two reasons. Firstly, you are losing some electrolytes through your sweat, all of this sort of thing. So putting some of those back in is good. And the other thing is that usually the electrolyte tablets are flavored, and just getting a bit of flavor into your water can help you want to drink that amount of water. You know, if you have to drink 3 or 4 liters of plain water a day, that's quite an ask. Whereas actually, if you can get some flavor into that, it might make it a little bit easier. So definitely go with some electrolytes as well. Don't have to go overboard, but maybe just in one of your bottles, just have a tablet dissolved, and that can just help get a bit more into that. In terms of vitamins, minerals, a couple of things you can go down with that. I think, you know, you've alluded to it twice there, Dave, you know, kind of illness at high altitude that's not altitude sickness, and just maintaining your immune system, which can be a bit difficult at high altitude. So it's not necessarily something we'd say, you know, you must do, but we will have some people look to take a vitamin C supplement, a bit of zinc, just to support the immune system while they're up there, particularly for longer trips. The longer you're up there, the longer your immune system's slightly spore. You know, you're not necessarily getting the same access to fresh fruit and vegetables as you would at home. You know, the food is remarkable, isn't it? But it's not necessarily all lots of fresh fruit and veg. So those can be good. And then we will have some people, particularly if they're at risk for it, just use an iron supplement while they're at altitude, just to help with the acclimation as well. It's not an essential. It's not something I say, you know, for someone to do unless they know they're at risk of being low in iron. or they know they have low iron, but it's something as well.
Nice. Good stuff, guys. A couple of questions around age, I think, is a really good one. I know Jerome asked it, I think Andrew as well. Are us older guys more susceptible to altitude? And then Jerome, does age play a factor as who suffers with altitude? I thought it was a really good question.
Not particularly. You could have two, you know, and we've trained people across the age ranges, you know, all the way up to 70, 80 plus at least. And you can have two 70-year-olds respond just as differently as a 70-year-old and a 20-year-old. It really is quite individual, to be honest with you. And so that's where really the value of getting in and getting a little bit of testing comes in, because, you know, we can't predict just by looking at you and taking some risk factors. That's not really a way of looking at it. So it's your physiology and it's your individual response, really. The only thing that sometimes people who are more experienced in the mountains, which might be older people, it might not be, the one benefit that they do have is maybe just being able to manage themselves a little bit more. So I think classically the person who gets altitude sickness is like the young fit guy, because you're like, you know, I'm a rugby player, I'm a marathon runner, it's no pain, no gain, I'm just gonna push through whatever. Whereas actually, if you're a bit more prepared to say, well, actually, I've got a headache, I need to do something about this, then maybe that's beneficial. But in terms of just susceptibility to altitude, no, unfortunately, there aren't any factors like that that we can use to say who's more at risk. It's all individual.
Yeah, and some good points there as well. And what you said around the last bit there around experience, essentially, or knowing how to manage your body. Mm. You know, I know Dewi and Nige there who were off to EBC. I think Dewi's there at EBC a week today, and then Nige is off to Kathmandu on Friday. So obviously spring season's really kicking off now. Mm. And I suppose just having that little bit of how to manage your body, because I know Derry was asking there, any last minute tips, you know, and mentioned mindset or something else. But what you said was really good around, you know, how do you manage your body? How, you know, if something, you know, generally, like on a day-to-day basis or when you're out hiking, have the same approach, right? Like look after yourself. You know, if the advice is go slow, listen. you know, if you know you need to drink 3 liters at least, you know, it listen to the kind of basics if you're going out to altitude soon. Get that done.
So I think you've highlighted two of the key things there, is walking slowly and drinking plenty of water. Those are two of the most important things for looking after yourself at altitude. And then the other is tracking any symptoms as they do come through. You know, have a headache, how long have I had that headache? Am I feeling nauseous? Has that nausea progressed at all? All of that sort of thing. So track your symptoms and don't be afraid to communicate with your guides. I think I'm sure this as well, but the thing that we see is that people are almost afraid of admitting that they have any kind of symptoms. They see it as this big thing and they're going to be sent straight down the mountain as soon as they have a headache. And of course, it's just not the case. Everybody on the mountain wants you to be. So they're going to do what they can to make sure that's the case. And so just, they can only help if they know how you're feeling, really.
Yeah. Cracking advice, mate. I 100% be honest, be open, because, you know, especially with your guides, you know, they're looking after you. Mountains are an inherently dangerous place. You know, but it's challenging. It's why people go there, for a challenge.
Yeah.
But you've got to temper that with a little bit of just listen to your body. You know, be open with your guide. Tell them how you're feeling so they can help you best. Essentially.
Yeah. One thing absolutely. I like is, you know, Lee Wyatt's comment there, you can only go as fast as your slowest member. There's a lot of truth in that, because nothing happens on these trips until the group is together, you know, so rushing ahead and arriving at some point before the rest of the group means that you're just waiting, you know, and you know, there's no medal for it. There's no one waiting for you, you know, with a space blanket and a banana. You may as well slow it down, relax and support the other members of your trip. I think a lot of the time military guys have a good mindset on that. You know, every person I've trekked with who's been in the forces has always had that. They're always, you know, some people might think they might be gung-ho and just sort of run off, but actually they're far from it. You know, that team mindset is amazing. One question from Sam Weller, which we do get a lot as well, James, and I know you've probably heard as well, but certainly they're still out there. What are your thoughts on the altitude workout masks? So the stuff you might, you know, make yourself look like Bane in the gym.
Yeah. I knew he was going to say that.
No way.
Yeah, absolutely not. Look, I think we had this conversation in October at the training weekend. Yeah, talked about it as well. And I think the fact that they've had to rebrand to be training masks rather than altitude masks or elevation masks or anything like that kind of tells you what you need to know. They don't do that. What they do is they make it harder for you to breathe, which trains the muscles that you use to breathe. So the muscles around your ribs and your diaphragm, which can be a useful thing. But for most people, that's not necessarily a limiting factor in your oxygen transfer and in your ability at altitude. So in our experience, the issue that you get with that is that you put one of those on and then you just can't train hard. So you're not getting the altitude benefits, nor are you kind of training, you know, your muscles, your musculoskeletal system really hard to get the benefit from it. And so it kind of down regulates the benefits of your workouts. There are specific circumstances where it can be useful, but generally speaking, it's not an altitude simulator, and it's not necessarily enhancing your workout too much further.
Yeah, bang on. We get that a lot.
Follow-up question, would it improve your VO2 max training with one of them?
Yeah, often. In terms of it training with one of with our kit or with one of them?
No, the mask, the Bane mask, yeah.
Oh, it's unlikely to, unless you have a problem with the musculature around your lungs that actually enables you to breathe. Then it's unlikely to improve your VO2 max.
I guess any benefit you might get is negligible compared to the loss in performance that you would normally do. So if you go out for a 10K run or whatever without one of those masks, you can push yourself. Mm. There's a lot more aspects of your fitness that are being trained.
Yeah.
Whereas if you just use one of those masks, you're sort of 50% as good as you would, but the intercostal muscles are really strong, which I can't say I've ever, unless I've coughed hard, nothing's ever happened to them, you know?
What you said is a good point, though. Why they had to change the name of them is that look, they are good in some areas, but when it comes to altitude, you know, it's just not the same, is it?
Exactly.
So yes, it's important to know. And just while you said it as well, you mentioned obviously the training weekend in October. We did bring some of the masks where we took, you know, customers up to like 6,000 meters. Just a reminder for everyone as well who's watching, we do have some spaces left on the 9th of August training weekend, where James is going to be with us. That is in Brecon Beacons in Banner Brycheiniog here in Wales. So yeah, if you do want to get yourself booked in, hopefully one of the Yetis will drop a link in the comments. Obviously you can get to meet us and Dave. There's two people in there. myself and Dave and James will be there as well. And we'll have a cracking weekend of trekking in some beautiful mountains. So there's the link there. So have a little look, 9th of August. James, looking forward to seeing you. It's been too long.
Yeah. It's brilliant. Brilliant weekend last time around. We got a lot of value from that. And it'll be cracking.
Exactly. I was actually just thinking, our training weekend in the Brecon Beacons, you know what that would actually be perfect for? If you were planning on going to Summit Gran Paradiso,
I knew you were going to say that.
Because myself and Andy do have a trip going over there in July, date, and it's one where we actually trek with the Ever Trekkers as well.
Yes.
And there's still some spaces left on there. So
there are.
Maybe the guys can pop a link in there as well.
Waiting to drop the link.
Yeah, I'm sure that. I don't think I primed her to have that link ready, so it's just a scramble for it.
See the panic through the window here, but no, it's I'm sure we'll get the link in. But yeah, as Dave said, Gran Paradiso, the highest peak solely in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely beautiful national park and a really good summit as well. If you're thinking about taking on some of the higher summits, so obviously we'd love to see you there in July as well. Good little shout out. Well remembered, Dave, wasn't on my list.
Mate, it's occupying my mind. I want to get that full because I love it. I had such a great time in October where we trekked to Tupacal with the Ever Trekkers.
Yeah.
And normally, you know, when we do treks, we don't actually get to know a lot of the people that go on our trips, aside from, you know, the Tuesday tune in and a few emails. So I don't know. It's great. I love spending time with people on the other side of it. It's why the training weekends are good.
Carl Phillips has a really good question as well. Hey, Carl, nice to see you on the live. How far in advance of high altitude trips did you visit the altitude center? That was a good question.
Yeah, great question. As early as possible for that initial testing, because the best case scenario is you go, well, look, you know, you're going for your trek in a year's time. We've identified a bit of susceptibility, but actually we only really need to work on that in the last 4 weeks. So, you know, crack on, get fit, and we'll speak in a year's time. Worst case scenario is you go, oh, you're going in 4 weeks. Yeah, yeah, but I heard about you a year ago. You go, well, we haven't got, you know, we haven't got as much time as we might like to actually action anything and put any training in place. So getting that initial consultation in early is really useful, so we can identify individual levels of susceptibility and put a plan in place from there. Generally speaking, we're looking for things like Everest Base Camp, Kilimanjaro. Often the training will be across the course of kind of 4, 5, 6 weeks, something like that, at a very general level. So looking to get kind of at least that amount of time is good.
Debbie's there, too late to come tomorrow, then he's flying Tuesday. Maybe. Well, at least after your second trip, you'll be able to kind of take the learns from your first trip and then plan ahead. Definitely highly recommend
it. He's just got to wing it this time. That's fine. Sam Weller's asked, does your body structure play any part to play in altitude? For example, he's 6'8". Would he feel altitude more than shorter people? So I'm assuming, I always tease my mate about this, he's 6'7", like, does he need Diamox? You know?
Yeah. It's a good question. You've undermined it there, but it's actually a very good question.
Carry on.
Again, it's one that provided that you're healthy, no. Obviously someone who is bigger should have bigger lungs, so although you've got more muscle mass, you know, you're taller, there's more of you to support. Provided your lungs are big enough, then you can still get as much air in, you know, relatively speaking, as someone else. So no, it shouldn't. Part of what we do in the consultation is a bit of a health screen. We'll look at the lung function to understand exactly that sort of thing. And then it does really come down more to how you get on as an individual. So no, you know, people who are bigger, people who are smaller, there doesn't seem to be any particularly distinguishing factor there, really. It's more on an individual basis, much like we were saying with age.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, bang it. That's a really, really good question. Yeah, I like this. Just looking at some of these then, so in terms of caffeine. Yeah, Carl. Hey, Carl, I hope all is well. Talks about caffeine. Does it have any pros or cons at altitude? I know, obviously, I'm a coffee drinker myself, but any thoughts on that, James?
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't be relying on teas and coffees to get you 3 or 4 liters of water a day, because obviously caffeine, it does have a little bit of a diuretic effect, and it does raise your heart rate a little bit, both of which happen at altitude anyway. So you probably want to stay away from it a little bit. The flip side of that is if you're a habitual tea or coffee drinker, you also don't want to go cold turkey. You don't want to suddenly withdraw from caffeine completely, because you're going to have a horrible time. You're going to get headache. You're going to be cranky, all this sort of thing. So you probably want to drop down a little bit compared to what you normally have, but I wouldn't necessarily advocate for removing it altogether. If you see what I mean. So it's a little bit of a balance to be struck really.
Awesome. Jerome has asked, what's the lowest altitude you might expect to experience symptoms?
Good question.
Well, I mean, it's a really good question, because we do have people who experience it and come and train with us for skiing. You know, we will have people who are going and skiing at 2,500-3,000 meters, and they feel it. They feel the effects, even though they're straight up and they're straight down. And one of the big things we often say with the base camp trek is that part of the challenge is you're in from Kathmandu to Lukla, and you're straight in at about 3,000 meters, and you're trekking from there. And you might not feel it at those heights, but we can see in someone's physiology very quickly, because we do test at that level when people come in. We can see very quickly that for a lot of people, the blood oxygen saturation is dropping quite quickly and to quite a large extent. Which is surprising. You feel absolutely fine, but your physiology underlying is definitely affected. And so even though you're not necessarily feeling it, if your physiology is affected and that's going on for a couple of days, you're just on the back foot. So you might not be feeling it massively at that level, but it's just chipping away at you so that by the time you get to 4,000, by the time you get to 4,500, you're just not quite where you might be otherwise.
Yeah, that's fascinating as well, because I remember our guides always say, look, even, you know, in the first couple of days of any high altitude trek, it's important to manage your pace, because that process is happening. And if you feel fine, so you go fast, you're even giving yourself even less time to acclimatize to those changes. And the issue will compound itself day on until, and we actually 100%. Trekked with someone who was one of the fittest people I've ever knew. He looked like he was carved out of granite. And he was he used to do like ultra marathons.
He's a nice guy. He's a really good
an
guy.
Amazing guy. I'm not going to mention his name because this isn't really his fault. At the beginning, he was treating every hill like a challenge. That was his mindset. Yeah, that's how he tackles life. But then when he got to Garrickshep, so 5,000 meters, he was like a broken man, you know. And I think he really struggled with why he couldn't keep up with people who were nowhere near as fit as him. And it's because they had longer to acclimatize.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it didn't go as fast, you know. It does help, doesn't it? And you know, you know, he's a great guy, really, clearly really fit, strong mind. But I think you know, as soon as you got above 5,000 meters, there it was. You know, it was against him. You know, and he was still keeping the water going. And we did go up Kalapatar, which was just near Everest Base Camp. And you know, he got to the summit, but he struggled the entire way. And even he was like, thank you so much. You know, because obviously he wanted to make sure he got that. He obviously loved going to Everest Base Camp, but he wanted Kalapatar as well. But yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? You look at the broad spectrum of fitness levels, but altitude is a real leveler.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, obviously the fitter you are, you're going to enjoy the experience a lot more, because you're not as tired, as fatigued, but it is a real leveler. And that's why it's so important, some of the things you're talking about today, James. Obviously, I know we sound like a broken record now, but we talk about hydration, we talk about speed.
Yeah.
But it's as boring as that. But you want, you know.
Speed helps acclimatize, does it?
Not that type of speed.
Pace. Is it pace? Sorry.
It's not that sort of show.
Sorry. Yeah.
I knew that was coming. I could see the cogs whirring.
I was just waiting for an example. You know, you can take the boy out of Newport.
Is that revenge? Is it for one of my puns?
I had to learn to fight back with the puns, didn't I? Because you'd be on a trek and it was like pun warfare, and you have to pun as hard as you get punned sometimes.
Ah, thanks, guys. You've got to be done.
Yeah.
Some other questions as well. I know we got about five minutes left, I think, before we before we almost finish, James. Bri, how you doing, Brian? I hope all is well. So Brian is one of our famous ever trackers who got stuck in Kathmandu during COVID, which many moons ago now. But Bri's obviously he's reached Everest Base Camp, has been to Killy, but he says something to discuss as well. Fitness levels play a part in suffering from altitude. I know we've discussed it a little bit. I'm quite fit for my age and haven't suffered yet. Fit for your age, Bri, is an understatement. Bri does a lot of marathons and a serial runner, isn't he? And what was it he did? Brecon to Cardiff or Cardiff to Brecon?
Yeah, I think it's Brecon to Cardiff Ultra. He
did. Absolute beast. But yeah, Bri, I hope all is well. Lee, a really good question. Do you have any idea how accurate the Garmin Pulse oxygen indicators are on the watches?
No, we haven't... Yeah, we haven't validated them specifically. I'm always a little bit nervous around them, purely for the reason of where they're located. So I've got my watch on now. Where do you wear a watch on there, and the sensor is there. If you were to take someone's pulse, where would you take it from? Other side. That's where the blood flow is stronger. We actually use pulse oxes that go on the fingertip, because you've got lots of capillaries in the fingertips. There's lots of blood flowing through there. So I think they're as good as they've ever been, you know, because they've been out for 5-10 years or whatever. So they're as good as they've ever been. I wouldn't rely on it. If you're interested in getting a reading, you can get a pulse oximeter quite cheaply before, but you can get one quite cheaply on Amazon. So if you're interested in that, I would just get a proper one.
Yeah. I bought one when I had COVID, just out of curiosity, just to see if it made a difference.
A lot of people did.
I noticed it's like maybe a point. Really? Went down or so, but apparently, I didn't get it too bad, but I think on Amazon, you know, during the great hand sanitizer Great. Well, actually, the oximeters and ear temperature things also went down. Interesting. Sorry, did Brian's questions, does it matter how fit you are?
I think it's because I realised as I was asking it, sorry, Brian, that we'd already discussed it.
Oh, is that what it was? Okay, yeah, sorry. Because I was like, did we just zip past that one?
As I was reading it, I thought, sorry, Brian, we literally just discussed it, but I wanted to just give Brian a shout out because he's one of our famous ever trackers. He didn't mind getting stuck in Kathmandu for 10 days because luckily they had a bar.
Yeah.
At the hotel. Yeah, so, which very quickly ran dry.
They're still trying to restock it, I think, actually. Yeah, so I'm just looking through now just to see any sort of other high good questions that we've missed.
Chris Collins, how you doing, Chris? I hope all is well. Long time no see. Here we go. So we got heading Killy this year. Here it's pretty cold in August. Suffered mild altitude impacts at EBC last year. Will the cold Killy nights make it worse? Good question.
Yeah, James, very good question. I don't think that the sort of temperatures that we're talking about there will make too much of a difference, is the honest answer. When you're dealing with real extreme cold, then it can do for two reasons. Firstly, and we're talking about, you know, when they went and did the K2 winter, much less cold.
Yeah.
And it's the low air pressure that causes the lack of oxygen. So in those sorts of really extreme cases, it can do. The only difference you might find is if it's colder, can start to impact how you resort to the altitude a little bit. So I think in August, there's not so much of an issue there, but it's definitely one to be aware of that if you're working harder because of the cold, then that would cause you to respond maybe a little bit more poorly to the altitude.
That's fascinating because I was listening to a podcast recently and it was about people that overwinter in Antarctica.
Yeah.
And it said that quite a lot of people who work at the South Pole suffer altitude sickness. But when I looked up the altitude, I was like, really? That's quite surprising. But actually, that makes sense now because they're like minus 50, 60 degrees Celsius. Yeah. So I imagine that is quite an extreme example of what you just said, James, where the air pressure is a lot lower. Yeah. So it's almost like the geographical altitude is made, you know, physiologically, it feels higher because of the environment.
Yeah, which is mental, isn't it?
And you'll find that with Denali or those sorts of climbs as well. They behave like much higher mountains than they actually are in that sense. Yeah, exactly that.
Yeah.
That's it. It's super interesting, isn't it? And James, obviously coming towards the end now, like thanks for talking about, like, it's really useful. I hope the EverTrackers obviously you found it useful as well, which is great. And just a last reminder, like I said, all EverTrackers in their members area, so when you log in, just click on the Altitude Center little thumbnail and you'll be able to go through to a form where you'll be filling in. And literally James is waiting to receive your form being filled in as he it'd be obviously James and thanks for that as well. I know you've helped a lot of EverTrackers over the last 4 years or so, really, isn't it? It's been a long time since we first got on the phone.
absolutely no, it's good, and it's good, you know, people heading off all over the world, and obviously with your new trips heading off presents new challenges and new opportunities for people to get out into the mountains, which is awesome.
Yeah, amazing. And obviously, you know, if someone does want to jump on the training weekend with you, James, it is amazing because this has been an hour, but they can bother you with these questions for 2 days straight. And he never, ever, ever gets annoyed, or he's always smiling and happy to answer. it would be great, though. It is. I think they're the most valuable training weekends, actually, when we bring people in as well. This outside expertise that they can learn from, especially with the equipment you bring and everything like that. It's really one of the, if you're going to book on one, that would be the one I go on.
Exactly. Brilliant. Nice little plug there, Dave. I like that.
That's all right, mate. Yeah, I was just got to get that in at the end.
Great stuff. Well, look, thanks, EverTrackers, for joining in. Obviously, we'll be back next week. James, obviously not back next week, but I'm sure we'll get you on another TTI. It'd be great actually to do another one down at the new Altitude Center. That would be quite cool.
Yeah, absolutely. We're watching space. I think that's a conversation we've been having in the background. So it'd be great to have you guys up.
Let's do it.
Great stuff. All right, thanks everyone. We'll see you next week.
Nice one.
Thanks so much, James.
Take it easy, guys. Bye.
Bye. Cheers. Bye. We'll be right back.